One, two, three, four.
How can museums remain relevant in the digital age where visual imagery is more accessible than ever? What role do museums play in fostering creativity and innovation in their communities? Stephen Riley is the founding director of ReMuseum, an independent research project housed at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas. ReMuseum focuses on advancing relevance, governance, and sustainability in museums across the U.S. During his time as director of the Speed Museum in Louisville, Kentucky, Riley presented Promise, Witness, Remembrance, an exhibition in response to the killing of Breonna Taylor and a year of protests in Louisville. In 2022, he co-wrote a book documenting the exhibition. A Yale and Stanford law graduate, Riley clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens before launching a successful entrepreneurial career, experiences he draws upon for public engagement initiatives. Stephen Riley, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you, Mia.
So Crystal Bridges Museum has undergone an evolution in recent years. Can you just tell us a little bit about the establishment and history of the Crystal Bridges Museum? And when you became founding director of the ReMuseum Project, you know, what was your mission?
So as the founding director of the ReMuseum Project, I work for the director of Crystal Bridges. But let me tell you a little bit maybe how I got there. And then I'll talk about how Alice Walton built the amazing ecosystem to support the arts in Northwest Arkansas. I'm by nature a professional lawyer, entrepreneur, an art supporter, a collector. I've been on the boards of museums in Louisville, Kentucky, where I live, and in New York. I love seeing what artists can do to help us reshape our vision of the world. In 2017, I became director of the Speed Art Museum, Kentucky's oldest and largest art museum. It was, in effect, what I called a 90-year-old startup at the time. It had reopened after a complete closure for a large-scale renovation. And so my work with my colleagues was to figure out how to bring it life. And we were able to innovate and try a lot of new things in service of its mission. When I left that position after an orderly succession in 2021, I spent a lot of time thinking about the challenges of museums, how it's so hard to cover their budgets and their expenses outpace their revenues, how their assets often act like liabilities, and how their own rules have sometimes made it hard for them to innovate. And what I didn't know was how Alice Walton, with a great entrepreneur and philanthropist named David Booth, were having similar conversations at that time. 20 years ago, Alice Walton began with a crazy, bold vision. She envisioned this place called Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, which opened a little over a decade ago, and today attracts over 800,000 visitors a year in a region, Northwest Arkansas, with only 500,000 citizens, and in a town with only 40,000 residents. So Alice thinks big, and she thinks differently. They came up with the idea of putting together a project, which became ReMuseum, which I run, in their words, to help museums break out of these legacy systems and become more innovative. So I joined the project early last year, gave it a name, and now I'm trying to figure out how do we help museums in that effort of becoming more creative, more innovative, how to break out of their legacy systems, matter to more people, and thrive?
That's amazing visitor numbers when we see that even organizations like the Met Museum have been suffering. So how do you do that? Just break it down, because I think people want the secret formula.
Well, I wish there were one. Crystal Bridges, part of the benefit for them is just becoming so different. But I think civic pride was part of it. Alice, when people in New York, frankly, mocked at her and the idea of a museum in a town of only 40,000 people when she was buying great masterpieces of American art to situate them there. And I think in some way, part of the underlying message is that art is good enough for everybody. And when you go to Crystal Bridges, you literally see everyone. You see people in trucker hats, multi-generational families, school children from all over Arkansas. And I think they continue to work really hard to present art and present it in a way that will feel really relevant to the people that they are really seeking to serve, and realize that it's very hard for a museum sometimes not to feel like it's talking down to the people who are visiting it and the people they hope to attract.
Indeed. And if you could go further into some current exhibitions or ways you're bringing that into schools or inviting educational groups, how you engage then, as you say, you come from a commercial background, and how people can understand the creativity that is involved with design and other elements of their life that they may encounter more frequently so that they feel empowered and inspired.
Well, at Crystal Bridges Museum, they're doing it in a lot of ways. It's hard for me to say all of them, but one of the things they're doing now is thinking expansively around their own mission. And they're adding a dramatic scale of gallery space to focus specifically on indigenous and craft as art. And they realize that that can fill gaps and show relevance about the American story, about the whole variety of American stories for all of their visitors, while also showing craft, which can really connect with the creative capabilities of all Americans and their understanding of what can be art. What ReMuseum is looking at is how does the museum field do that? Because in many ways, the field has been held captive to its own sense of the canon of art history, as well as the source of the art that forms its collections, which means largely coming from collectors who also reflect the patterns of the marketplace, the patterns of the pre-existing canons of art history, rather than always trying to fill gaps that may speak to the audiences they serve. And at ReMuseum, that's what we're trying to do, is figure out how to support and ask museums to hold themselves accountable to the communities that they serve.
Yeah, this is also part of a network, and I don't know how vast it is. It's forming now. So how do you engage with them? Because there's been a lack of transparency with some museums being more open, others not.
Well, the basic framework for our work, because ReMuseum is about promoting innovation in general and mission-based innovation and not trying to tell museums how we think they should change. But what I stepped back when I began the project and looked at is that the art museum field in America has undergone one of the most radical transformations of any field I've ever seen in my lifetime. So 30 to 40 years ago, the average American art museum said that its purpose, its mission, was to preserve objects for the benefit of the public. The public in a very passive role in that formulation. Today, it has dramatically shifted, and our own research has documented that 90% of American art museums now center the public in their mission statements. They say that their purpose is to serve and engage the public with art. 60% of them don't even mention objects or collections. And yet, are they really doing the things to reflect and serve these new missions? In fact, when you look at them, their policies, their norms, their degree of transparency, which you mentioned, their budgets, seem to be much more anchored and aligned with their past missions than with their current missions. What we showed in a research project we released earlier this summer was that while the missions may center the public in the art museum's stated purpose, the transparency and the information they share does not center the public. And only 17% of American art museums share both their number of visitors and their consolidated financial statements, something that's really a base level of information. They all have these information. They all share it with their boards, but they don't yet share it with the public. So part of ReMuseum's work is not just to promote innovation, but to ask museums and boards in particular to hold themselves accountable to the missions and the public that they serve.
Yes, and we've heard, as you say, so sometimes what's being said and what's actually being shared. I remember Chris Durkin, former director of Tate Modern, now director of Fondation Cartier, told me, and I think that is true, certain institutions are more open, but they say that their purpose is like people found that it's a great place for encounter. But how do you enable those encounters? And I think it must also go hand in hand, because you know that we work with over 100 universities, many of them in the States, with the fact that arts programs just are not as funded. So there's still this elite bar in many institutions where people just feel a little bit intimidated about entering. And it has to do also because it's just not been promoted at a young level when people are being educated.
You are correct that certainly in the U.S., funding for arts education at the elementary school level as part of the humanities at university and graduate school level has been dramatically cut just year after year, decade after decade. Museums can't turn that around themselves, but what that means is museums are now being called, I think, in a very acute way to actually fill some of that gap, not just by promoting and encouraging and making school visits easy for young students, but also in all the work they do. Now is the time for museums to be getting out of their own elite pasts and histories in the ways that they present information, in the ways that they make art relevant and accessible for all people. But we know that too often the average American sees the museum as kind of the purview of the elite, the place for the art historian where they may feel talked down to or not understand the rules. I mean, we just looked at a very simple level, and something museums can easily overcome is how they talk about their own exhibits. And if you take the content that museums publish on their websites, their easiest to find content, they're writing at the graduate school level. So if you're the average American reads at the eighth grade level, let's just say you're a high school graduate. Well, only 3% of museums in our recent survey are writing content at the high school senior level, even, for the average American to read and understand. So what they're saying, it might seem to many, is that we're here for you if you're academically trained at the college or graduate school level. And if not, good luck trying to figure out what we're talking about. So museums themselves need to make sure that they are contributing to the accessibility and relevance art and not to the idea that it's not for them.
Exactly. It's strange times because at the same time, museums are fighting for eyeballs. There's all this digital distraction. At no other time, I think, has the average person felt so empowered in a way, even without having art training, to maybe create or co-create something that is artistic, although the AI co-creators might be taking a heavy part of that burden. And at the same time, this period of flourishing creativity outside the museum then is a competition as well. People are so often experiencing the work of art outside of the museum that sometimes it doesn't necessarily draw them in to see the physical works of art, or sometimes I think can make it hard for us to experience the work of art with fresh eyes.
All that I agree with. I think you've caught exactly the challenge and the opportunity for museums. The opportunity is that we have never had a public that is more passionate and obsessed with visual imagery. And so that's what museums have the opportunity to take advantage of. If the owners of the best original imagery in the world can't figure out how to take advantage of the fact that the world has now become obsessed with exactly these treasures that we have to offer as museums, then shame on us. This is the opportunity to say, if you're spending all day scrolling on Instagram or other apps, looking for amazing imagery, come and see the origin source. Come and see the real work. Let us figure out how to make that connection. At the same time, we need to be learning from them because there is a threat and there's a lot more innovation, frankly, going on in the visual world outside of museums, whether it's apps like Instagram or Pinterest or commercial art enterprises. Many people are finding these immersive art experiences are a wonderful way to get to know and love the art of mainstream artists like Van Gogh or Monet. And the museum field generally looks down on that. And I understand it's not necessarily deeply art historical. It's not trying to transmit a deeper degree of knowledge. And yet, how can we learn from them? How can we learn from the Sphere in Las Vegas, which is employing artists to connect with musicians and give tens of thousands of people a day a way to experience visual art in a new way? The question is not, museums might say, well, I don't want to sell out. That's not the question. The question is, how do you tap in to that energy that the visual imagery is creating for humans all across the country that museums are failing or are not feeling like the places where the public can come experience? There are exceptions. I think that in the world of AI, museums are really doing interesting work. The Museum of Modern Art last year worked with the great artist Rafik Anadol to create a work really grounded in the permanent collection of MoMA in a revolving, mutating, explosive giant screen of AI art. And I saw people sitting in the lobby at MoMA transfixed for hours by this work. It was a great new entry point for young people, for people who might not have felt that the art at the Museum of Modern Art was for them, to feel that, yes, this place was leaning into them. Many art critics scoffed at that, whether that was real art or not. But if you looked at the eyes of the visitors, it was art in their eyes. And we have to be a little more expansive in what we share for audiences whose minds may be growing faster than museums are.
Indeed. And for us, and it relates to our project, it's maybe engaging more with the viewers' understanding of the creative process or the different layers that go into a work of art, which I think is always something. It's great to visit a museum, but it's also great to revisit it in your mind when you go back into your communities, into your schools, and then think, how is this made? It's a more intimate experience, I think. And so with these multi-sensory exhibitions, it offers that. And what are some of the other unconventional and innovative ways that or formats that you're exploring in order to increase diversity in exhibitions and also bring art into the community to attract visitors who might not typically visit a museum?
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could take credit, but what I try to do is shine a light on examples of great innovation in the field. So happy to share a few, and we can talk about others over the course of our conversation. One that really excites me is the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Been a very successful museum, archiving and presenting the legacy of Warhol's really crazily important career and art to Americans. but also living in a city that's struggling a lot and actually attracts more tourists than it does people from Pittsburgh. So as they thought about that conundrum, they looked at the community and they realized they could develop a program by employing young digital creatives from the community, a majority of whom are BIPOC or LGBTQ+, and they pay them to generate content for the museum. So they're creating digital content to promote the work of the museum, making it more relevant to young people like them in Pittsburgh, which is, of course, the mission of the museum, to matter to the people in the community it serves, while also taking work from outside contractors and developing careers as digital creative talents in the marketplace, getting degrees from the Carnegie universities, and going out into the community with better jobs. So the museum, by kind of breaking out of its previous preconception of its purpose and how to do its work, is now becoming making the artwork of Andy Warhol more relevant to the community while also providing work and jobs to the community at the same time. And as a result, they've attracted millions and millions of dollars of foundation support from Pittsburgh community foundations that are saying, we're not just happy that you're a great museum. What we're really happy is you're leaning into your mission in this new and creative way. Another example is a company based in Columbus, Ohio, called Orange Barrel Media, and they make really creative digital billboards. They architects design them, they feature artists work on them, and they generate revenue for the people who own the real estate where they're based. They've done these in commercial locations from Sunset Boulevard to Manhattan, and now they're working with museums and cultural institutions, which are all often located in really valuable pieces of land. And what they're doing is not just generating revenue by selling billboard space, they're actually helping get the museum again out of its own walls, advertise its programming, which many people who drive by the museum may have no idea about, and presenting digital art on the screens as well. So the museums are getting a win-win by generating revenue by also driving more mission-related relevance to the communities they serve. So what I'm excited about is the museums that are hunting for these new ways to matter to people. As you said, touching a chord in kind of the hearts of creativity. People want to be creative, want to feel connected. Many museum practices have made people often feel disconnected to their own creative souls and talents. How do you actually make it show that the museum really wants to support creativity among all the people in the public?
And we've seen a lot of crossover. As you say, you mentioned technology, but of course how the sciences are, of course, creative and the visualization of same, there can be a great transdisciplinary possibilities. And how are you increasing or looking to expand more engagement along those lines?
I think in terms of education, what I'm intrigued by is the ways people are looking at it in all different sources. You know, some museums are attached to schools. One of the ways I think museums are doing is trying to connect the audience with the act of interpreting the art itself. What we know and have known for a long time is the public wants to be engaged. They want to see interpretation, the way that the art is made relevant, be more of a dialogue and not a monologue. They want to actually be engaged in it. So one great American museum hasn't made this public yet, but they're going to start opening their exhibits long before the galleries open by creating digital content and letting the public engage with the creation of the exhibition long before it actually opens in the museum itself. I think the museum of the future is going to be much more open to the creativity of its audience. And rather than view it as a layer of expertise that can only be shared on terms of the experts, the work and the relevance will grow in the depth of it if they actually engage their audience, whether it's school children or the public, in the way they're showing the art. I'll share one quick example. There's a brilliant woman named Joyce Tsai who runs the Clifford Still Museum in Denver. And when she got there, they said, well, Joyce, we have a specialty in early childhood education. We've been researching it and we have programs around it. And we actually have a show of Clifford Still's art that's been curated by infants. And Joyce is very bold, but also and really smart, came out of academic world. And she said, that's nonsense. I'm not going to belong to any museum that's letting infants curate the shows. And they said, give us a chance, let us explain it to you. And they showed how they had actually presented art to literal infants who couldn't walk yet. And their reactions in their eyes showed the human reaction that translated to the reactions of older children and adults. And they literally did use the reactions of these infants to prepare and curate a show of Clifford Still's work for the general public. And Joy said, okay, I'm sold. She said, not only that, we're going to continue making this a special niche for the Clifford Still Museum. We want to build artist housing that actually supports artists with children. That's just one example to show when the museums think a little differently about how can we share the art, who's there to help us figure out how to share it, how to interpret it. The work actually gets richer. And rather than the fear that we're going to lose our authority or confront disrespect because people won't appreciate our expertise, I think the museum, by opening that up to the public, actually increases respect. It doesn't need to be a mystical temple that's only controlled by the sacred priests and priestesses. It needs to be a place, a living and breathing kind of church where everyone has a role.
I think that's so true. And it seems like childhood is the place when we all feel we have permission to be artists, where we're all really creative without this sense of boundaries of who we are. You don't have to earn your right to express yourself. Children, you just see, you put on music, they dance, you give them a pen, they start scribbling on the walls. And sometimes it's really great. reminds me of the conversation I had with Laurent Lebon. At the time, he was director of the Musée Picasso, but now, of course, he's at the Pompidou. And so they have these different initiatives. I love these initiatives that also bring the museum open at night, because at night, art and museums should be places of dreaming. And so it's also blurring those boundaries. And you feel more at home. So initiatives that you could even spend the night in, spend the night at the museum. Or these intergenerational, as you say, bringing in not just young people, but older persons, the grandparents, bringing the grandchildren to have art experiences with their grandparents. One generation inspiring the other so that they can share their different views. And so it's so nice when it can reunite people and connect them and to see what we have in common, but also, you know, share our differences. So I love all those things that allow us a new perspective on art.
Yes.
I know your work is broadly celebrating American art, and of course the Crystal Bridges does that, but talking about how you increase these dialogues maybe outside of America as well as celebrating America and its different regions.
Well, the mission of ReMuseum is not related exclusively to American art. The mission of Crystal Bridges Museum is, but we're focused on American art museums. That said, so that global art is a big part of it, but also so are global museums. And increasingly, we realize there's a lot to be learned from museums elsewhere. For example, the European museums are far ahead of American museums on climate issues and environmental sustainability. American museum practices have built up a set of standards of care built around absolute perpetual protection of the object without regard for what that costs in emissions and expense in running the museum itself. And also without regard, really, whether scientifically those standards are absolutely necessary to preserve the art. What we see the European museums doing, and we hope to learn from and encourage some sharing of information from them, is in response to greater sensitivity to climate change and also the rising utility costs, especially after Russia's war in Ukraine, is actually a much more creative approach to the standards of care of the art, how to care for the art that's both responsible and respectful to the object, but also being responsible and respectful of the planet and the climate. And we're seeing no impact on the art and reduced utility bills, greater benefit for the planet, and also a lot more sharing of art between museums, which sometimes have created barriers to actually getting art out of storage so it can be seen by more people.
Yeah, I think that's something a lot of museums were really reflecting on, of course, with the war in Ukraine, but also in COVID. By force, there was not the transport going on and allowed museums to think locally and think about what was in their archive, just gathering dust often.
Correct. And the same thing is happening there. They often sent couriers personally escorting art from one place to another. And now many museums are realizing they don't need to do that to get art safely from one museum to another.
And in terms of environmental exhibitions that ReMuseum or Crystal Bridges may be involved in, this is something very dear to our heart. We have our sister podcast, One Planet, and we will also post this segment on that. What are reflections on the ways that arts can really reconnect us with our planetary nature and our planetary balance? I find that Mother Earth and the natural world is like the first artist, and we just, like, as artists then, how do you say, become inspired by it, or do our kind of echo it in our own human way, but they are it's the primary artist.
Well, I'm proud to be affiliated with Crystal Bridges, whose mission is to be a place where art, architecture, and nature come together. And in fact, the museum design that Moshe Safdie, the great architect, came up with there, it's not placed on the top of a hill, it's placed at the bottom of a valley. And actually a stream runs underneath and more or less through the museum. So in that sense, it's quite environmentally humble, but also means that the people visiting the museum travel down through this valley, through this creek bed, which is filled with art, all kinds of beautiful sculptures from Louise Bourgeois to Yayoi Kusami to Roxy Payne and Deborah Butterfield on the way to the museum. So it really immerses them in nature before they even get to a gallery. At the same time, I think many museums from COVID and otherwise are realizing that outdoor spaces for art have their own ability to impact the public. And so what you're seeing now is an increasing number of outdoor sculpture parks, some of which are not restricted to the same museum hours or ticketing policies. They have to meet the public where they are, which often is not inside the museum gallery, but is walking nearby or wanting to be in the shade of a tree or bringing their children to a playground. And if the museum can impact them with art in that kind of setting, then it's doing its mission just as effectively and maybe more so than inside its own galleries. So I think nature is going to be a very interesting place to see museums get more engaged in the future.
Yes, and of course, celebrating folk traditions or indigenous traditions and indigenous artists, of course, that's always been at the center of their work. And it's hugely important through our projects. And with One Planet, we're always getting the independent artists and, of course, the students and faculty to reaffirm their commitment to the planet and just try to make their little daily changes. It's the subject of our next exhibition at the Sorbonne when we return there. And speaking of the international dimension, I want to bring in Aileen now, who is one of our team members from China, and she has some questions for you.
As a current student who's studying in the fields of art history and curation, I've become more conscious of a way of discussing art with people around me. And at the same time, I've noticed the way I address artworks and practices is sometimes so influenced by a Western-centric art education that I grew up with. So are our perspectives being constructed with Western timeline? And are there any examples you have seen or created that can be a great approach to introduction to art history or the histories of a museum outside of Western framework that may help with those who might be new to the field to construct their understanding from a different perspective?
What a great question, Aileen. And I think it illustrates in a poignant way how these structures that museums themselves and art historians have created are now actually become kind of a hindrance to the field more than a benefit. I'll use a couple of examples. Two journalists and researchers, Julia Halpern and Charlotte Burns, have showed that museum collections themselves are not just a reflection of the Western canon, but are likely to remain a reflection of the Western canon for decades and decades to come. Because of the work that museums collected reflected the tastes of their donor class and the art historians who informed their collections, they still are very overweighted towards white male Western artists. And not only is that the case, and the fact that museums want to change, however, is the policies that have created that make it unlikely that change is going to happen, because the collectors who still are the source of most museum collections are continuing to collect in the same ways. And even though they may be adding a few Black artists to their collections, they're not doing it at the great depth of which they're continuing to collect white male artists. And so the field needs to think radically different about how it's going to grow its collections and how it's going to change the canon of art that reflects the people it serves. And so I think that to your listener's question from Asia, in the art historical canon, it's the same way. I think we have to figure out how do we reflect and serve the public. So I would argue that we just get radically more community-centered in our modes of interpretation, because it's going to take a long time to change academia, to change the way that art history is taught and the Western canon is grounded in it. And those are important efforts. But if you want to see change at the museum level, you can do it on the walls. You can do it in the way that you engage and invite the community to help you interpret the art yourselves. And even for a curator or an art historian, just getting that kind of public input and response can make your museum much more constituent and community-centered. And there are curators. A member of our advisory task force is a Brazilian named Vivian Zavataro, who teaches at the Ulrich Museum at Wichita State in Kansas. She's been educated in Europe, and she's bringing a very community-centered approach to interpretation and art history. So that would be my fastest way to do it, is I think just get the public in immediately. And there are museums looking at how to store and exhibit their permanent collections in place where they're interpreted by the community, because the community has not been informed and, if you will, indoctrinated in any particular canon. They're indoctrinated into relevance in their own lives, and that's the kind of perspective they'll bring to the work in partnership with an art historian or curator.
Indeed. And when you use this word community, it also reminds me that we're talking about indigenous art or in different cultures. There isn't such a sense of authorship necessarily. There's a sense of community ownership or traditions being passed on and a collective process of art making, which maybe goes against the ideas that are embedded in the ideas of the Western canon and what is a masterpiece. So I think that we really have to, as you say, re-examine some of our fixed ideas to embrace these different traditions and ask ourselves, why do we put this work of art on a pedestal and others not so? And it goes to the question, it's, well, why are we not valorizing more? I think it's changed a lot recently, but more women artists or others. Why is it defined as crafts being somehow demoted in terms of what is fine art?
Yeah, I know your work focuses a lot just on the creative impulse at all large. It actually means kind of considering the museum itself kind of an act of creativity between the people who lead it and the communities they serve. When I was running a museum, I often found that the rules that were prescribing certain things or certain expectations we had in the museum were actually inconsistent with the way that artists approach the world. And it seemed very strange to me that we had an institution that seemed to have made it almost impossible to act the way an artist acts. Artists, of course, are the reasons we have museums, because if someone hadn't woken up one day and made something so extraordinary that we wanted to preserve and share it with the world, we wouldn't have a museum. And yet the kind of spirit that artists have, which is open-ended, entrepreneurial in the sense that they may reinvent themselves from day to day, not telling people what to think. Artists invite you into new ways of thinking. Sometimes that spirit is actually hard to find in museums, where it feels like the training and the system has been built to present on very specific terms with a very specific interpretation to the public. And sometimes I think if we just opened up the museums to the spirit of artists themselves, we would be just fine.
As you've mentioned there, that curation is part of the creative process. I really believe that's something that I've been talking about for a while. I call it the invisible arts, whether it's those people behind the scenes, the curators, the teachers. You know, it goes in theater, there are all these behind the scenes, the producers and things that help nurture an idea, or the front end artists who sign their name to it. But without this culture, then we need the artists, but we also need these, I call it the invisible arts, those in the background who nurture an idea from its inception when maybe nobody yet believes in it.
I don't know. I certainly don't want to sound like the role of the curator is diminished in a reimagined role for the museum with its community. I think it asks curators and educators and museum leaders to really lean deeply into their own missions and to the communities they serve without fear. That's another thing. Artists don't have much fear, right? That's the amazing thing about them. And I think museums would do well to copy artists in that respect as well.
Yes, we should all learn to be a little more fearless so we don't have to be perfect right out of the gate.
So this summer, I've been visiting many museums in my hometown, Beijing, and I'm very delighted to see that many are offering free entry and have attracted a lot of children and their families. Among young adults, such as my friends and colleagues, it might be harder for them to find interest in art museums and sometimes find learning arts very difficult and believe they're not able to understand works in the museums because they didn't grow up being influenced by the arts. So what do you think are the factors that young adults are looking for in today's museum experience? And how do we break the ideas that learning art is difficult and not for the everyday people?
Well, I think we'll talk about two things. You've talked about how appealing it is to see museums make themselves accessible, right? I think if museums really want to center the public in their work, they have to think about their practices. Are their opening hours really accessible by the public? The average museum is open primarily during the hours when most people are working. I think they should just be asking themselves if they really mean to welcome everyone. Are they doing it at times where people can even get there? One of the greatest debates in the history of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York was in its first decades, where its founders said they would never open on Sundays because it was the Sabbath, until New York City, which has always been a major funder of the Metropolitan Museum, said that it was going to deny funding if it didn't make the museum open on what was then the only day when the average New Yorker did not work, when people still were working a six-day week. And the museum finally relented and allowed itself to be open to the public on Sundays. I think museums have to recognize that they still have incorporated practices that don't always feel like they're making themselves accessible. You know, there's a set of questions around how to make the work, what I would say, relevant to the public. And we have talked a little about that. I think they need to meet the public where they are, speak in the language that the public uses and can understand. Really wonderfully innovative museum professionals have told me that they didn't feel comfortable until even a few years ago sharing biographical information about artists on wall text. The average member of the public would have no comprehension of why it was viewed as irrelevant to talk about where an artist came from or what their family was like. And yet the field had somehow neutered itself of that information and a degree of relevance that really walled itself off. Sometimes I think it's just a question of listening as much as you can to the public and people like Aileen and the people she sees enjoying museums so that they can get the kind of information about the art that will make it feel real and relevant to their lives.
Exactly. And that's so surprising, this kind of varnish that we have traditionally been putting over objects in museums. But you mentioned some artists who really had a grounding, like Warhol, and being so influential and being reaching out to the commercial world and coming from these backgrounds that are not, some of them are elite, but some of them are really working class and that's their way out. So why should we put so many varnishes? We can be intellectually stimulating while still being plain spoken.
I couldn't say it better myself. And I love your idea that the varnish that we apply to paintings is a metaphor for the practices sometimes in the legacy systems that we've used to make the work of the museum itself a little harder to see and enjoy.
I think as long as we can speak to people where they are, how they understand, that's true communication. And it's not speaking over their heads. I think that's the point of art usually, is to stimulate our imaginations and think about serious issues, but it's the heart and bringing the heart and mind together. That's always what the arts have done best.
My name is Aileen Xu. I'm currently a student in critical and curatorial studies at the University of British Columbia. The discussion so far has inspired me to think about my current interests and research focus, that is, creating more accessibility to knowledge within the museum space through interactivity. As a prospecting curator, it is very inspiring to hear from our guest about his previous experience of observing and interacting with museum visitors, and that creates a gap with the museum's presentation of professional writing or highly academic information. And as a solution, our guest mentioned the importance of looking for ways to engage, to relate to guests and their experiences, and especially creating digital and interactive contents. Through my research, I have also learned from scholars that there are great advantages in interactivity in art, especially the potential to introduce a completely different approach to the relationship between artworks, artists, and the audience. In traditional meaning-making process, especially in the Western culture, the meaning already existed within the artworks and has to be searched for and aligned with the artist's intention. I can see this being a challenge for both museums and visitors if the artworks involve advanced concepts or topics hard to relate to. However, an interactive medium, the interpretation is no longer fixed, nor communicated in a one-way fashion from a mediator such as the artist or the curator to the audience. It instead allows interpretation to happen in real time, filters through different personal perspectives of individual audiences. The meanings are created by audiences themselves in combination with their understanding of the world. So, I think what our guest has talked about, the importance of focusing on the experiences of audience outside of the art history field, can not only expand the museum's traditional target audience, but also in general allow more integration of arts into the everyday life. And I hope we can see more innovative approaches that opens the interpretation of works in museums in the future. And now, back to the interview.
I'll use an example where when I was running the Speed Art Museum and we learned from the public in Louisville in 2020, we were not just going through COVID like the rest of the world, we were also an epicenter of the world of police protests against police brutality following the killing of a young Black woman named Breonna Taylor in Louisville by our police department. And the world was looking to Louisville, and Louisville itself was questioning its own self. It was really all we talked about. There were protests going on every day. Most of the workers of the museum had participated in those. And we were really asking ourselves, what's the role of art? This is not a time for varnished art. How can art be of service to our community at a time like this? And we saw a path forward when we saw the portrait of Breonna Taylor that had been painted by the amazing artist Amy Sherald. Amy is now best known probably for her portrait of Michelle Obama, official portrait in the National Portrait Gallery. But she had painted a portrait in collaboration and sympathy with the family of Breonna Taylor that first appeared on the cover of Vanity Fair. And the Speed Museum then organized an exhibit with the guest curator Allison Glenn and our own community engagement specialist Toya Northington. And we did a lot of listening. We listened to the family, to the mother, Tamika Palmer. We listened to the community. We listened to artists and people who'd been victims of gun violence nationally. And I'll just use one example of what we learned from that is that it was very easy to think that the artwork we were presenting in the show that we built around an exhibit called Promise, Witness, Remembrance that the museum built around Amy Sherrill's portrait, it would be easy to use the word heal, as though art might heal the community. And what the community told us, they said very clearly, don't use that word. It's kind of presumptuous. We're not going to get over all of this pain in one visit to the museum. So we stopped using that word, and we used the word process. We said art has this extraordinary ability to let you feel and think what you need to think. And what our community, they hadn't had the time and the space and an outlet to just process their own feelings. And so it may sound small, but by not using the word healing, we weren't telling them what to do. We weren't presuming the outcome of their visit to the museum or the exhibit. And it opened us up to all of the thousands of different ways that the thousands of different visitors, the needs that they were bringing and the needs that art could fill in a way that nothing else can fill. So again, if we just listen and are willing to adapt our own thinking and approach to sharing and enjoying art ourselves and with others, I think the answers are there.
That's so moving. And I'm tempted to say healing, but I understand what you mean by the word processing. There's a sense that you never quite get beyond to the point of forgetting a trauma, but it stays with you. And it can make you stronger, obviously, when you understand that we're connected to these tragedies more personally or distantly, but it affects us all. So we talked about technology. Of course, a lot of change is happening in museums now. We talked about the ways that AI is changing our conception of what is creative or what we thought was strictly the domain of artists, but now open to a wider variety of people. How do you believe that museums can also examine these questions about the future of technology and the future of work and perhaps prepare young people and old people for uncertain futures? We don't know what the world will look like in 5-10 years. It's moving so rapidly.
Well, that's a big question. I think museums themselves haven't figured out the future of technology. And so they have to have some time and space to explore that in different ways. But I do think that artists can, you know, what we always have the answers at hand in artists. When I think about a challenge the museums face, what do artists have to teach us? And artists can always show us the way into the future, right? We talked about artists aren't scared. They don't lead with fear. There are always artists who are showing us something about the future that we didn't yet know or couldn't understand ourselves if we just let them. And so I think that there are great examples of museums doing this, but just getting out of the way. I think I talked about how when MoMA showed the work of Rafik Anadol, they were letting the world, the public, see their collection in a way that imagined a different kind of future, not just for the visitor, but for the collection itself. It wasn't all stuck in storage. There it was on the wall, promoting a creative experience and an opportunity to think about AI and the future of creativity differently. So I think artists have often showed us, at least made us feel safer about the path forward. And that's what I would encourage museums to do today, because we're not going to know the answers about the future of tech, the future of work. If some theorists are right, there'll be less traditional work in the future, and maybe there'll be a lot more time for people to visit museums or make art themselves.
Yes, it could go several ways. And I think that right. We're on it with some of this AI legislation, but yeah, we have to rethink tomorrow. So as you think about the future, those teachers or mentors or collaborators that have been important to you, what you tell your own children about the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what are your reflections finally, though you've already shared many, about the importance of art, cultivating creativity, and what you would like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, there are a lot of things to be scared about in the future, whether it's a climate crisis or rising number of wars and conflict around the country and the rise of autocrats and dictators around the country. But I'm not only an optimist by nature, I love the future. I find that artists generally are as well. And those things that you said, what I love about artists is they're also the most generous people that I know. They're solutions oriented. They may not find a specific answer, but they can open a way of thinking that helps us find answers. And so that's what I tell my children, is to embrace the future and be prepared for the new ways of work, of engagement, of citizenship that it may require. Because the only thing about the future is it shows us that many of the ways that we've been doing things are deeply flawed. And we have to always have the capacity to unthink the things we've been taught and the systems that we've adopted and embraced, which continue to create a lot of good, but also figure out how to balance them with better practices for the future.
That's so important. So thank you, Stephen Riley and the Ree Museum and Crystal Bridges, for all you do to increase access to the arts, improve educational engagement, and open our eyes to the ways art can help us feel and think. By engaging our imaginations and through sharing stories behind the art and fostering these immersions, you open our eyes to better tomorrow. So thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Well, thank you, Mia, and thank you for promoting and magnifying the creative process. I appreciate it.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Young Mishaski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Eileen Chu, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Eileen Chu. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Associate text editor on this episode was Danielle Cordovez Flores. Additional production support by Sophie Barnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.